No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show that is on a mission to make America think again. I'm your host, Michael D. Brown, United States Senator Emeritus, and along with my amazing co-host, Liberty Jones, we are interviewing the people that are making it happen, not always in front of the camera, but always ahead of the curve. We're not going to tell you how to feel or who to vote for. We're just putting the information out there because it's what goes on in the shadows that really makes the world go round. So come listen and learn, because a vote is a terrible thing to waste. And now more than ever, we need everyone listening, learning, and engaged if we're going to make America sane again. Tonight's guest, we have a very special guest, Zahra Amanpour. Zahra has spent her adult life as a human rights activist, advocate, and a proud supporter of the Iranian resistance movement. Born during the 1979 Iranian Revolution in Tehran, Zahra's life has been defined by a struggle for freedom and justice. We're so happy to have her here tonight, especially with what's going on in the Middle East, going on with Iran. And we want to talk to her. And so welcome to the show, Zahra. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very grateful to be here.
Can I start by asking you, we want to talk to you because of your background. We want to talk to you a lot about the women of Iran. So let's start there. I know that I grew up in an Italian family where male was the preferred gender. If you were born in my family as a guy, you really didn't have to do much. The women, however, did a lot, but they maneuvered inside on the gray area and the restrictions that were put on them by the culture that they came from. So let me ask you, given the restricted life that Iranian women live, how do they maneuver inside the gray lines? What do they do to make their lives work?
Yes, so it's important to understand that the history of women in Iran is a very sort of different one than I think a lot of Westerners may know. Iranian women traditionally have been actually very active in society and have been, you know, they, similar to what you just described in your culture, in Italian culture, of course, women did do more of the household work and more of that type of traditional women's work in the home. But from a social, cultural, and economic perspective, women in Iran have actually traditionally been much more engaged than a lot of other societies, especially in the Middle East. So when the Iranian regime came to power, which we'll talk about a lot more, it stripped them a lot of their personal rights, their personal civil rights, in the sense of like how they were allowed to dress and needing permission from a male in the family to be able to do things. Like go to school, like travel, like participate fully in society, get a job. And then from a cultural perspective, it basically imposed an ideology that said that women are not of the same worth as men, and that you know, women's place is in the home, and doesn't really don't have the same sort of value or place in society as men do. So this was very counter to the direction that women were already moving in society. They were already gaining all sorts of cultural and economic freedoms. And so when this happened in 1979, it really changed the society drastically and unfortunately really oppressed 50% of the population. Women, however, you know, being women, have always resisted in these types of circumstances. And in Iran, this couldn't be more true. Women have fought back and resisted by pursuing, and, you know, to the men's credit, too, in Iranian society, the majority of men in Iran are not on board with this ideology and this regime that has been oppressing all of society, but especially women, for the past 45 years. And so they have been very willing and able to support the women in their cause. And women have been able to get around these oppressions, these laws, these restrictions in society by doing things like going to get education. More women in Iran have degrees than men. More women in Iran have STEM degrees, graduate STEM degrees, than men. Women are much more connected via the internet and other types of digital platforms. So they've been able to sort of bypass some of the restrictions by sort of getting credentials under their belts, and having, you know, really sort of fighting back in the family life and in the culture by sort of taking their place in society and taking their place in the home. So no matter how much the regime has tried to keep women from participating in society and from having a role, an active role in society, it has actually worked exactly the opposite for them. Women in response to that have taken on more cultural and economic significance in the society and have been the leading the leaders of the resistance for 45 years and continue to be to this day. So what we're seeing in Iran happen right now on the streets and the protests, which I'm sure we'll talk about more, is really being led by many, many women in society. So it's kind of worked against the regime, what they've done. It's only emboldened and strengthened women from a cultural perspective. And hopefully the future of Iran will be, as a result, have women at its forefront, politically, economically, and everything else.
Well, let me tell you that half of what you just said was a surprise to me. And let's hope you're right. Let's hope that's exactly what happens. And yeah.
Hi, Zara. I'm Liberty. You know,
hi, Liberty.
Hi. I'm really inspired by the Iranian woman. I do think that sometimes, you know, in times of loss, in times of oppression, communities seek each other to rise against that. And, you know, do you think that maybe there is potential for this to be something that could happen in the U.S. as well, with the current situation where people who are being belittled by the systems of government could actually unite and empower themselves because of this discrimination? Do you think that's something that you see could happen here with the current situation?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's the only way to fight the sort of fascist and oppressive forces that are trying to divide. You know, the traditionally colonialism and other forms of oppression have divided and conquered, right? So to counter any type of systematic oppression, I think we have to do the exactly opposite of what they want us to do, which is we have to come together, we have to unite, and we have to fight back as one united force. I think in the United States, this is starting to shift in that direction. I think over the last 10 years, there's been so much polarization in our society, and everybody's just zoomed in on our differences. And it doesn't help that, you know, every algorithm is trying to do that to us, and every media outlet is trying to do that, and et cetera. But I think the people are waking up. I think it's got, you know, sometimes it has to get so bad that we have to sort of get to the bottom in order for us to be able to see clearly. And I think, sadly, our society is in a very sad place in terms of how we see each other, in terms of how we connect with each other, and in terms of our hope for the future and where our society is headed. So I think we are at that defining sort of pivotal moment in this society where I see more and more people questioning, why are they being told to hate the other? Why are they being fed information that is, you know, so often misinformation in our society, and sort of why are we only looking for ways to find differences rather than our shared humanity and shared sort of struggles that we're fighting with in our society? So I think I, from what I can see and what I'm feeling, I think people are waking up, and I think people are moving in that direction. We see this in the protests in recent years, where people have come to the streets and said that, you know, whatever the cause may be, we are in this together. We are one force. And if one of us is being oppressed, all of us are being oppressed. And you hear that more and more in chants, in different types of demonstrations and protests across the country. I don't think the mainstream media is picking up on that enough, but I do think people like yourselves and podcasts and more grassroots type of media is pushing that. And that is the form of media that we are all migrating towards, because we feel like we're getting more truth from more grassroots types of media. So my hope is that if the grassroots movement, in terms of podcasts like yourselves and other forums, continue to kind of promote that type of approach and that type of unity across all of us, that we will continue to move in that direction. I feel a sense of solidarity building amongst the people of this country, because we are all being attacked from for different reasons and from supposedly different angles, but it's really all one force, and I think people are starting to see that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's scary that it may be one force that's spreading around the world. But let us take solace in the fact that the Iranian women are standing up, and perhaps they'll teach us that we need to do that and stop the isolationists and open us up to the world. That's what I'd love to see. But let me ask you, absolutely, this all this new kind of role for women, or the new way that women are seen since the revolution. Let's talk a little bit about the revolution, okay? Because my first boss was Jimmy Carter. And as you probably remember, they tossed the Shah out in 1979. They took hostages. They took some of our friends hostages at the embassy. It was a big deal. That revolution was a big deal. So let me ask you, since women play such an essential role, how did the revolution come about? Why this throwback? Do you have any feeling about that? Why was it thrown back to a religious kind of government, which now, unfortunately, is the situation in India and the situation in mm-hmm. other places, in the United States? They want, you know, I'm sure that the MAGA people would be happy if we were all Christian and fundamentalist Christian. So, and the government was run. They even say that. They even say the government should be run like Jesus Christ. We want the government run. So what is it that inspired the people of Iran? Was it the corruption from the Shah and his government, or was there more than that?
Yeah, it was a combination. So there's a long history here under the Shah that led to that. Under the Shah, there was a very brutal police force called the Savak that was very, very violent in the way that it kept law and order, or its laws in order, I should say. And it really only benefited the wealthy of the country and fought for the wealthy of the country. And the vast majority of the country was subjected to if there was any kind of dissent, there was violence and persecution brought to people. And that was not seen in the West, because the part of the country that was connected to the West were mostly the wealthy Iranians that were benefiting from relationships in the West and the way that the Shah was running its government. So most Americans and Europeans were not privy to the fact that the vast majority of Iranians were actually living under this sort of very brutal sort of force. In addition to that, the economics of Iran were moving in. So the Iranian people started to want to nationalize their resources, especially oil, in the 1950s. And the prime minister rose to power who was trying to do that under the Shah. And there was a coup. There was a coup where the Americans and British people killed that prime minister. And the people had sort of were ousting the previous Shah, the father of that Shah, and the Iranian people, the Americans and British actually placed another Shah in his place and took out the prime minister that had the popular support of the people. And that happened in 1953. So that set a real sort of set the precedent for the revolution. And it took 20 plus years of frustration and anger with the government around basically taking all of the natural resources that the country had and selling it to the rest of the world, and the Iranian people, the vast majority of Iranian people, not benefiting from that, living in poverty, and then the violence that I described earlier on with the Savak forces, and then the sort of very, you know, rich being getting richer and the majority poor getting poorer, which, you know, rings a lot of bells these days in America. So that was what was happening before 1979. And that any kind of progressive movement that rose in the 1970s, which included the organization that my family to this day is part of and supports very strongly, the Mujahideen of Khalq, they were imprisoned and tortured and or killed during the time of the Shah. As the 1979 revolution approached, even though they were the ones that had sort of been the catalyst in moving people towards that revolution and telling them, you know, you deserve to have democracy, you deserve to have freedom, you deserve to have control over your own economic resources, etc. They were all unfortunately not available at the time when the tipping point came in 1979, the month that I was born in November of 1979. And there was a power vacuum that was created at that time where there was no progressive leadership in the out in society and people towards what would have been a better outcome, which is freedom, democracy, and a secular government. And so the Iranian regime led by Khomeini at the time stepped into that power vacuum, exploited the frustrations of the people, exploited the economic sort of disparities of the people, and said, we're going to, you know, through religion and through our approach, we're going to basically oust the Shah, and we're going to make sure that the people of Iran are never taken advantage of again. And so there was a power vacuum, and that's what essentially led to the regime coming to power. And they quickly, after they came to power, knew that if these progressive movements were allowed to be free or to allow to function, that, you know, the society wouldn't take to the new regime. So many of the people that were imprisoned under the Shah were, you know, there was tens of thousands of people that were executed by the regime as soon as they came to power. Many of those same leaders and progressive people were executed when the regime came to power. So that kind of continued, that brutal kind of crackdown continued through the revolution, post-revolution. People that lead the resistance now to this day were imprisoned, and some of them who sort of tried to run for, like, you know, when the regime first came to power, the people were hopeful that they would have a democratic, at least, parliament. They realized that they were under a theocracy, but they were given the impression that they would be at least be able to vote in their parliament and, you know, all of that. But all of those people, even though they got votes, the majority of votes in those different districts and municipalities, they were not allowed to take their seats after the first election. And so they were all marched, kind of marginalized and taken out of the equation. And so that created that, and the regime at the same time consolidated its power and took, put its grips on women's throats, as I always say symbolically, and took hold of the society and sort of by brutal force. And so it was a very disappointing outcome for the Iranian people, because they thought they were moving towards something better, but unfortunately at that critical moment, it was robbed from them by the Iranian regime that they've been living under ever since.
And therein lies the lesson for America, right? I mean, your first description of these people, you could have been describing the Trump administration, sadly enough. I hope we learn from that. And Liberty, it's your turn to ask a brilliant question. I'm sorry I didn't properly introduce you. Go ahead.
Well, you know, can you talk to us more about, you know, directly, you were there. What are some of the human consequences that came after this?
There's so many. The sad reality is that there's not an Iranian that doesn't know somebody in their family or somebody that they loved that hasn't been tortured or killed by this regime. And that's how prevalent the abuse and violence is in the country. So what that means from a sort of day-to-day, everyday person's perspective is, if, you know, the regime's tactics, for example, are that if somebody, if your son comes out to protest on the street or your daughter comes out to protest on the street, the entire family is held accountable for that. And so they wiped out whole families to teach a lesson to society around if you let your kids act up, we're going to teach you all a lesson. So entire families were imprisoned and executed. And have been over the time, even these recent uprisings, that's one of the tactics that they're implementing. And, you know, you can imagine it's terrifying to people, and that's what has kind of kept them in power, because, you know, the older generations who remember what happened in 1979 are saying to the younger generation, please don't stir things up. You know, we're all going to pay for this. Your sisters are going to pay for this. Your brothers are going to pay for this. Your family's going to pay for this. So that's one kind of tactic that it has used over and over again. It also disgustingly implements showcases public executions. So one of the things that is common is after any kind of dissent or uprisings, it will take young people and execute them on cranes in public in the streets, so that people see it and don't dare to sort of protest again. From a bodily, daily perspective, women, for example, if they don't wear their hijab correctly, as we saw with Mahsa Amini in 2022, social media was flooded with images of women who fought back when that happened. But these women, if your covering on your hair is not proper the way that they want it to be, or if a guard is just in a bad mood that day and wants to take his disgusting anger out on another human, they can just take you off the streets, and women are brutalized and raped, and all kinds of horrible things happen to them when they're in custody. The political prisons of Iran are filled with people from everything from teachers who have said something that the government doesn't agree with, to doctors who have cared for protesters at time of dissent, to just normal people on the street that show any kind of that fight back in any kind of way, or are frustrated by the economic conditions that they're living under. The prisons are filled with political prisoners, and for the last, actually since 2022, every Tuesday there is a mass hunger strike in the prisons in Iran for the to stop the executions, as a way to try to get some more attention, international attention, to what's happening in the prisons in Iran. So I can go on and on and on, Liberty, about what it's like to live in Iran on a daily basis. Now, you know, at the same time, you have to understand that even in these types of brutal, oppressive situations, people somehow persevere. People somehow find joy. People somehow move forward, right? So the Iranian people are extremely resilient people, just like most people who live under oppression are. And they have somehow managed to, under that, still continue to move themselves and their society forward, and are very, as I mentioned earlier, very highly educated, very technology savvy and connected. It's, you know, if you go to the capital, it's a metropolitan, like, amazing place. So, you know, it's this sort of contradictory combination of this government's intentions and tactics with the will of the people and the resilience of the people. And so that's what you encounter in Iran. When you go into people's homes, it's full of love and joy. And I mean, if you've ever had Iranian food, you shouldn't. If you haven't, you should. Delicious food and, you know, all of those warm things. And people, that's their way of sort of fighting back in their own homes. So, but the day-to-day economic and sort of cultural aspects in public are extremely oppressive.
Well, let me ask you, will a change in government, I mean, some of this has to be cultural, right? Some of it is the way women are viewed in Iran is cultural. So will a change in government affect, how will that affect Iranian women? A change in government, a change in the legal system. Is this what people are protesting right now? Is that their hope? Their hope is to get a better government that's more egalitarian and will treat people more equally. Is that what they hope for? Or is it just like the Shah, they just want to get rid of a bad government?
No, they want to. And during the time of the Shah, they wanted this too, but that they weren't able to get there because of so many interferences. But the Iranian people have been struggling for democracy and freedom, and they want a secular government. Actually, the vast majority of Iranians are not conservative at all. They're very progressive people, and they are not. Like what the government you see now does not reflect them in any shape or form. So what they would like, and with women at the helm of the resistance, there's a momentum there that exists that women would actually be sort of catalyst in all of this. And we believe that's what's going to be the tipping point. Because if you want to know, if you... the best way to fight your enemy is to know your enemy really well. And the women of Iran know their enemy very well because they have been the ones that have felt that the most. So we believe that, and the resistance has been fighting this, like on the streets of Iran, they're not saying, you know, make our life better or let's reform our government or let's do this. They're saying down with the dictatorship. They don't want a dictatorship. They want it. That is the number one chant you hear in the streets of Iran is down with the dictatorship. They don't want this regime anymore. They don't want the Shah anymore. They don't want any type of dictatorship anymore. They want to have a democracy. And there's the National Council of Resistance of Iran, which is the most organized resistance group in the country that has 490 different ethnicities, religions, and populations of the country represented on that council. They have a plan, and it's led by the majority of the leadership of the council is women, and the president-elect of the council is a woman named Maryam Rajavi. They have a plan that would transition the country from this, once the people topple the government, they have an organized plan to transition the country within 6 months to put a provisionary government in place that will transition the country towards a free election, which would then allow them to draft, elect their first, have their sort of first free election and have representation in government and then draft their constitution, draft, you know, the laws that would govern the country. So they have a very well-organized, well-thought-out plan they have gotten actually bipartisan support in the United States Congress and in European Union. Parliament and across the globe, where they've outlined their plan, outlined sort of what how they believe they can transition the government from this kind of a dictatorship to a free democracy by the people of Iran. And that's a really important point, because what they don't want is any external interference. They don't want anybody coming in and Trump bombing the country or anything like that. They want to do this. They want self-determination. They want to do it themselves and transition within 6 months to this this free election, and then start to build the country basically from there. They believe that once that elected government is in place, it will take another 2 years for the full government to be formed in terms of what will be the sort of equivalent of what we have here in the United States with a Congress and a finalized constitution. Well, not a finalized, but a drafted constitution, and et cetera, all of those types of things will take a full 2 years to complete after the 6 month election.
Well, I will say that the first thing I ever did as an activist was protest the Vietnam War, and that actually came to an end because of the Women of America. Mothers got tired of seeing their sons come home in plastic bags, and they were the ones that stood up finally and pushed the Paris peace talks. So let's hope Iranian women are able to do the same thing.
Thank you. I hope so too.
I want to ask a question based on what I'm struggling through right now with the United States. You know, as an Iranian woman who is an activist yourself, what are some things that are important to know and important to walk with when you have to lead a resistance where this many people, especially people in power, want to silence that voice? What are some important considerations, some important strength points that you have found to be successful?
Yeah, so one of the things that always has stood out to me about the resistance that I've had the privilege of being part of my entire life, and even here in the United States when I've participated in protests and demonstrations and this and that, is that, you know, one of the greatest acts of resistance is joy. And I know that that sounds counterintuitive, but if they can't take your joy from you, then they're losing, right? And I think our country is in this pivotal moment. This is one of the things that's happening, is that there's so many people in despair right now and really don't know where to start, don't think that they have the power to do anything about this, are sort of just, you know, paralyzed by what is happening. And I think one of the ways that you create a unified sort of front is finding ways as a resistance, even in the hardest moments. Like when I was a child and we went through times where, you know, we haven't talked about this yet. Like my father was killed by the regime when I was 8 years old, and everyone I knew had somebody that was killed in their family and was, you know, all of that. But despite all of that sadness and pain that came from being in the resistance and fighting back against the regime, I also remember as a child the amount of joy we had with one another, and how we, when we were together, we celebrated, we didn't let them take that away from us. And we had this deep sort of love and for each other when we were with each other, and they couldn't take that no matter what they did. So that's something that I think is very distinct in resistance that people don't realize. You have to fight back by not allowing them to take you out of what makes us human and what makes us connect to one another. We need one another in order to fight back. And the whole premise of the forces that are doing this and around the globe is, if we can make them feel divided and make them feel like they have no hope and no way of changing anything, then they're in control. And if you can fight back with some of the most sort of basic human attributes like love and joy, I think that goes so far in terms of bringing us back to what we can actually do and energizing us to do what we have to do. The other thing that I think that Americans are having a really hard time with, and I think that it's very understandable. We are a very privileged society. We have so much materially in this country that, you know, it's hard to even fathom how this would work. But one of the things that you have to be willing to do in resistance is sacrifice. And I'm not talking about everybody needs to go put their life on the line. I'm not talking about, like, you know, there's some people that go that far, but not everybody's going to go that far. It's much more about just realizing that for all of us to have, some of us have to have less than we have now. You know, we have to kind of think about each other in the decisions that we make. And we have to think about the shared prosperity of our country and one another. And how we move forward in that vein. So an element of sacrifice, whether that's material or some other kind of sacrifice, is needed in order for resistance against this type of fascism to be effective. And, you know, those are honestly the two biggest things that I've seen. You have to have the courage to stand up in the moment. It's the day-to-day small moments that actually add up to be so much more. You know, we often have the same feeling in the room, but nobody says it. Nobody actually says, that was wrong. What just happened there was not okay. What is happening right now is not okay. We all kind of shy away from being that voice and not want to be, you know, be sort of labeled as the one that causes trouble or whatever. But all, you know, when you take that, have the courage to say that or do something, I in my experience, I'm always surprised and sort of so grateful, because afterwards people approach me and say, I'm so glad you said that. I'm so glad you actually did that. I'm so glad you did something about what was happening, because I felt the same way. And I didn't know what to do in that moment. And it made me know that I'm not crazy. It made me know that we're in this together. So I think we all have to be more courageous in our day-to-day lives and know that we have the power to influence others by doing that and to create that unity and solidarity that's going to be needed to move us forward. I think the American people have so many beautiful attributes and sort of have overcome so much already, that we have so much that we can work with. We just have to figure out how to bring those pieces together and be on the same page about what we're going after, and not sort of be divided by our own personal individual needs and wants and all of that.
Well, I think that Iran has a PR problem with the people of America, just because we have this crazy love affair with our automobiles, and we see all the oil producing countries as our not really our enemies, but certainly our adversaries. We blame them for the price of gas. We never blame the oil companies that make billions and billions and billions of dollars in the United States. We never blame them for the increase in gas prices. We always blame the countries of the Middle East. So that's going to be something that's going to take some work. But let me ask you about that. How are we putting enough pressure on the EU designated the Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization just the other day?
Right.
And the United States has sent the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln. Have you never seen an aircraft carrier? It's an amazing war machine. That and several missile destroyers to the area. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Iran says, I mean, it seems to be talking out of both sides of its mouth right now. The foreign minister said he's got his finger on the trigger. And Trump said there's a massive armada on the way. It looks like they're preparing for war. But then today, they said that Iran said that they're ready to negotiate. If they negotiate, what does negotiations look like for you? What is it when, at the end of the day, what do you say, this is what I want in the negotiations? at what's real at this point that could be
I don't
accomplished?
believe that anyone should be negotiating with the Iranian regime at all. And that's a strong line that the resistance holds. We are not looking to reform the regime. We don't believe that the regime is reformable. This is a regime that executes its own children publicly on the streets, stones its own women publicly on the streets. This is not a regime that anybody should be sitting down at any table with and negotiating with. What the world needs to do, and what the European Parliament did, was a very good move, is to isolate the regime economically and politically from the rest of the world so that it is weakened internally and that the Iranian people can more easily topple the government. The Iranian people, this regime doesn't represent the will of the Iranian people and should not be seen as the sort of representative of the Iranian people. The regime has to fall. And the easier we make that for the Iranian people to do that themselves, the more we are supporting freedom across the world and creating a better world for all of us. So I don't, of course, want this to escalate. I do not want any kind of military force coming into Iran. But I also don't believe that negotiation is the road forward. There is a middle road, which is support the Iranian people, help them to get internet access so that they can get their message out and the world can witness what is happening within the country. The Western world and the rest of the world has a lot of capability when it comes to that. They can technologically support the Iranian people and help them to get their message out and sort of their images and things out to the rest of the world, their voices out to the rest of the world. They can put in place targeted sanctions against the Iranian regime that would take away their economic means and weaponry and their ability to attack their own people and to be a menace in the Middle East. They can uniformly support and declare the Iranian people have the right to defend themselves, even if that requires the Iranian people to engage in a military type of resistance. They have a right to defend themselves, and they have a right to rise and topple their own regime. And they can do that in a very unified way through different sort of mechanisms. And they have to hold the Iranian regime accountable for the injustices and atrocities that it's executing within the country. And they can do that through international courts. It can do that through different types of bodies around the world. So all of those things would further isolate the regime from the rest of the world and it would kind of suffocate them in a way so that they wouldn't have as much power as they have. The Iranian regime has itself economically, there's so many billionaires in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard forces. They have economically stolen so much money from the country. If we cut that all off, there's going to start be more strife within the regime itself, and the regime itself will fall, and the people will help that regime fall. So you have to be a catalyst in terms of supporting the Iranian people to topple the government. We should not be sitting at the negotiating table with the Iranian regime. They don't deserve that. They're not the representatives of the Iranian people. The Iranian people have made that clear to the world, and we need to support that, their cause.
Well, if we don't buy the Iranians' oil, won't the Russians buy it? Don't the Russians buy it? I mean, is there really that we can put useful sanctions on? Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Liberty.
There's always another right. They go this way. If you go that way, they come the other way. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. And so, I hope there's not a military interaction as well. Liberty.
Yeah, it's just going to lead to bloodshed on both sides. This regime is not going to just go down. It's 92 million people in Iran. It's a very, it's not a small country. And look what happened in Iraq. Look what happened in Afghanistan. Look what happened in Vietnam. This is not the way you can change governments. You have to allow this to come from the people themselves. And the world has a lot of different things at its disposal to use to put more pressure on the regime and lift up the people of Iran's voice.
And before I let Liberty go with another question, let me just ask you, is there a way people can support your effort? Is there a website that you want to give to our listeners or some way they can reach out and be part of this?
Sure. So, yeah, absolutely. Thank you for asking. There's a couple of things. So just from a policy perspective to understand sort of what's happening and what the people of Iran are asking for and the resistance is asking for. If you on social media, you can go to Iran_policy. That's the handle, Iran_policy. And we are on X, we are on Instagram. You can find a lot of different sort of forum there around what should be the policy when it comes to Iran. In terms of accurate images, because a lot of what you're hearing and seeing in mainstream media right now is very distorted. It is not actually what they're lifting up the Shah's son as the next government of Iran, and they're not sort of accurately reporting on what the people of Iran are saying, and they're really manipulating what's being said. So to get real footage and to get real sort of firsthand accounts of what's happening in the country, you can go to the National Council of Resistance of Iran, NCRI, National Council of Resistance of Iran, NCRI's website. If there's an English version of the website, so if you get to the Farsi one, just go to the English one. There's an English version of the website. You can go there, and every day they have a briefing. They show videos there because of, the resistance is, even though there's an internet shutdown in Iran, they're still smuggling videos out and images out and firsthand accounts of what's happening in the country. So you can get that from the NCRI's website. And if there's no voiceover, it's really like what it is, and it's accurate reporting. I tell people, take what you hear on the videos, plug that into Google Translate and hear it for yourself so that you know what the people of Iran are saying. Don't count on somebody else to interpret that for you and to give you that information. We have the tools at our disposal now where we don't have to have other people interpreting things for us. We can do that ourselves. So we should use that and really get closer to what is happening in the country and what the will of the people of Iran are, because we're not getting that from our mainstream media right now.
Liberty.
So if you were to give one final message to the mainstream media, let's say CNN is on right now and it's you, you're on the big screen, what message would you give to the people?
I would say that the Iranian people want the right to self-determination, and they want a freedom, democracy, and a secular government. That is what they want. They want nothing else, and they need the world's support to get there. And we all have to get to the truth of what the Iranian people want, and follow that truth instead of letting all of these other forces and, you know, the long history of this country be what dictates the next chapter of Iran. The people deserve democracy and freedom.
You know, that's been the mantra of the residents of the District of Columbia for 200 years. And I think about something we quote all the time from Frederick Douglass, which is that power can seize nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. So how do we make the demand? How do we make the demand? How does the world make the demand that the government changes? And will they change? Will they ever change without being removed from power violently, just drug away?
Unfortunately, I so in terms of what the people do, I think the people have to demand the truth of what is happening in Iran, and to know that truth, and not give the media, and not let the sound bites of the media dictate sort of the narrative around Iran. And I think that we all, and even internally, we all need this. We have to therefore tap into more grassroots media outlets and sort of more direct sources of truth to be able to do that. We have to question anything other than democracy and freedom for the country of Iran. Anything that's any other message like that you hear that contradicts that, then you know that it is not the true message and that you need to dig deeper or ask somebody else the question because you're not getting the truth from there. So I think that's something from a human level we can do. From a policy perspective, as I said, I think we need to economically and politically isolate the Iranian regime more and more so that it weakens inside the country. And yes, I do believe that the government can be toppled without any external interference. But unfortunately and sadly, I do not believe that it will be toppled without bloodshed. The Iranian people that came to the streets in the past month are well aware of what they signed up for. They know that if they're out on those streets, that the chances of them being killed, severely injured, imprisoned is very high. And that's the courage and risk that they're willing to take. So we need to honor that as a world, as a fellow human beings. And we need to know that they're doing that full knowing what the risk is. And not try to take that away from them and minimize that by saying, oh, let's just stop this now so there's no bloodshed. The Iranian people are willing to, just like the Americans have been over time, every time anything good has happened to this country, Americans have put their own bodies on the line and their own belief and their own sort of safety and security on the line for us to move forward, for us to evolve as a country. And that's what the Iranian people want to do too. So this idea that we have that like our job is to somehow be the savior and protect them from being injured. They know what they're doing. Just support them in their struggle and help them get there. They will topple the government. They have the means to do it, and they have an organized resistance within the country that will help them get there. And sadly, there will be bloodshed and violence involved in it because this regime is not going to go down without that. So I think that's what our job is as fellow human beings and anyone who is not in that country right now.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that the activists in Iran say that 6,500 people have already been killed. That's a terrible toll. And we certainly lost people in America during the civil rights movement, but not in numbers like that. In fact, we mostly lost our leaders, is what I remember correctly. But that would be a terrible, terrible cost. Now, let me ask you, since we're running out of time here, is there something that you want to say that we haven't asked you that you think it's important to say? Please, please say it, because we only have a few minutes left.
There's something I said a lot, so I'm trying to figure
you
out.
You did
what
say
I
a
didn't
lot,
say,
and we're
anyway.
Thankful for that. You know, because that's what, you know, we want to get information out to people. So that's exactly what we want to do. But is there a question that you wish we had asked?
No, I mean, no, I've had so many friends reach out to me and say, what's going on in Iran? You know, this internet shutdown, this and that. And we can't get any information out. And I know it's more difficult than we want it to be, but there is a lot of information still coming out, and there is a lot of truth still coming out. So I would just say to everyone to please don't forget about this. You know, we have become so accustomed through the media that like the topic only lasts for a few days, and we're especially under this administration, and then we're on to the next crisis, and then the next crisis, and then the next crisis. And it's desensitized us to what is actually each of these crises entail and what the significance of the human significance of it is for the people involved in it. So I just would ask that the people of this country and around the world that want to support the Iranian people to just stay focused on it to the extent that they can, to keep asking, to keep seeking information, because the Iranian people need you to witness what is happening in Iran right now. They need you to be, part of this this process of justice for them. We all have to sort of partake in that for it to be successful. So no matter whatever the next soundbite is, whatever the next crisis is that is created by this current situation is, please don't forget that there are a lot of people who've given their lives and are having to sort of give enormous sacrifice right now in Iran. And what they really need more than anything else from us individually is to not forget about them and to keep witnessing what is happening.
Well, I think that's a perfect way to end. Liberty Jones, thank you so much for another week of podcast and brilliant questions. And Zahra Amanpour, thank you for the important work you do. Thank you for joining us today. We hope the next time we have you on the show, it'll be to report that the revolution has been successful and that Iran is on its way to recovery. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Next week is the Super Bowl, so we'll be running a repeat. But tonight, we send this song out. We always close with a song, and we send this out to the women of Iran and the people of Minneapolis. Here's Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley. We'll see you next. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks.
Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.